Today is Wednesday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, unknown gunmen have killed a Japanese aid worker and five of his colleagues in eastern Afghanistan.
You know, they came under attack while Dr. Nakamura was traveling to one of the project sites in Jalalabad City. And it was early morning when these at least three attackers ambushed their vehicle, opened fire at them, and then fled the scene.
Plus, NATO leaders stress unity after video surface of several leaders appearing to mock U.S. President Donald Trump. The House Judiciary Committee begins its impeachment hearings today. Those stories and more are all coming up next. Unknown gunmen have killed a Japanese aid worker and his five colleagues in eastern Afghanistan. Officials said the deadly shooting took place Wednesday morning in Jalalabad, the capital of Nangarhar province. VOA's Ayaz Gul has more.
Ayaz, what can you tell us about who was shot and killed in this latest attack in Afghanistan?
Well, this was quite an unfortunate shooting incident today in the eastern city of Jalalabad, which borders Pakistan, that this 73-year-old Japanese medical doctor, Tetsu Nakamura, was shot dead along with his four bodyguards and the driver, who are local Afghans. You know, they came under attack while Dr. Nakamura was traveling to one of the project sites in Jalalabad City. And it was early morning when these at least three attackers ambushed their vehicle, opened fire at them, and then fled the scene.
Has anyone claimed responsibility for this attack?
No, so far what we have from the Taliban insurgency that they have nothing to do with this attack. And there is no other claim of responsibility as of this moment. But we do know that Jalalabad, which is the capital of Nangarhar province, has been the scene of attacks by local loyalists of the Islamic State terrorist organization, although the government recently has claimed that most of the districts in Nangarhar have been cleared of Islamic State militants. But again, as of this moment, there are no claims. So we don't know exactly who carried it out, but Taliban and Islamic State militants have frequently carried out such attacks in this part of Afghanistan also.
Dr. Nakamura has spent like a decade working in Afghanistan and was recently awarded honorary citizenship by President Ashraf Ghani. What is going to be the impact in the country?
Well, this is, you know, such a big loss for Afghanistan, you know, where millions of people are in need of urgent medical urgent assistance due to ongoing conflict and natural calamities like drought and flood. And the organization of Dr. Nakamura has been, you know, providing urgent medical services and, in fact, helping people on how to independently grow food to meet their food requirements, like helping them on how to do agriculture activities. I mean, again, this man was doing such an important work in a country where we know that people will continue to will be needing more and more assistance. And let me just tell you that Dr. Nakamura arrived in the region in 1984, like a few years after the Soviet forces invaded Afghanistan, and it displaced millions of Afghans. Families in the country, and most of them ended up in Pakistan in the border city of Peshawar, and that's where Dr. Nakamura arrived in 1984 and opened some medical clinics to provide services to Afghan refugee families. And then, you know, when things improved, he gradually moved his operations to the other side of the border and continued his work. But for the last 10 years, we know that he has been in Nangarhar supervising operations, relief operations for mostly refugee families. And that's what, you know, basically won him this honorary citizenship of the country, which was awarded by President Ashraf Ghani recently.
Ayaz Gul reports for VOA out of Islamabad. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
While NATO leaders are professing unity as they gather for a meeting near London, several seem to have been caught in an unguarded exchange on camera, apparently gossiping about U.S. President Donald Trump's behavior. In footage recorded during a reception in London at Buckingham Palace Tuesday evening, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was seen standing in a huddle with French President Emmanuel Macron, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, and Britain's Princess Anne, the daughter of Queen Elizabeth II. Trudeau could be seen in the footage saying that he was late due to a 40-minute press conference, and while the president wasn't mentioned by name, he continued to say that Trump's team's jaws dropped to the floor. Canadian officials didn't immediately respond to a request for comment, but President Trump did.
Well, he's two-faced. And honestly, with Trudeau, he's a nice guy. I find him to be a very nice guy. But, you know, the truth is that I called him out on the fact that he's not paying 2%, and I guess he's not very happy about it.
The president has canceled a planned press conference today and announced that he would immediately be returning to Washington following the leaders' meeting. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says NATO continues to be vital.
At this council, we have the opportunity to strengthen the unity of purpose that has made NATO the greatest and most successful alliance in history, and to take the new steps that are profoundly necessary to ensure another 70 years of peace and security.
Despite all that's going on, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the organization remains united.
Whatever our differences, we will continue to unite around our core task, to defend one another, all for one and one for all.
Throughout Wednesday, NATO leaders played down their differences. Before the summit near London, French President Emmanuel Macron had lamented the brain death of NATO due in part to what he called a lack of U.S. leadership. President Donald Trump branded his remarks as very disrespectful. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan suggested that Macron himself is brain dead. The infighting is mostly due to Turkey's invasion of northern Syria. Macron has complained that Trump pulled U.S. troops out of the region without warning his NATO allies. Some defense analysts say Turkey saw the move as a green light to send its troop in to attack Kurdish fighters in the area. The Kurds had helped the United States and its allies fight the Islamic State militants, but Ankara says that they are allied with Kurdish separatists in Turkey. Macron has refused to apologize for his remarks, saying he had ignited a debate at NATO about the importance of strategic issues. Kim Jong-un mounted a white horse again as North Korea announced it will soon convene a rare meeting of the ruling party's leaders. Those steps are seen by analysts that may be signaling preparations for a more confrontational stance with the international community. North Korean state media reports that for the second time in 2 months, Kim visited North Korea's sacred Mount Baekdu on horseback, this time accompanied by senior military officers aimed at instilling a revolutionary spirit in the people. Kim has warned the United States it has until the end of the year to offer more concessions to restart stalled denuclearization talks, or North Korea will pursue an unspecified new path. Hong Kong's government pledged $511 million in new relief measures to help bolster an economy battered by months of protests that have eroded business confidence in the Asian financial hub. The latest boost brings the government's total pledged amount of relief to $3.2 billion. The economy is reeling from a drop-off in tourism and a record decline in retail sales. The International Monetary Fund on Wednesday urged the government to deliver significantly more fiscal stimulus to address the downturn and long-term structural issues such as insufficient housing and income inequality. Pope Francis on Wednesday accepted the resignation of Bishop Richard Malone in Buffalo, New York, the diocese, following widespread criticism from his staff, priests, and the public over how he handled allegations of clergy sexual misconduct. The Vatican's embassy to the United States said Malone offered to retire 2 years before the mandatory retirement age of 75 after learning the results of the Vatican-mandated inquiry. The Democratic-led U.S. House Judiciary Committee held its first hearings Wednesday on the possible impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump when four legal scholars appeared before the panel to discuss the constitutional grounds of impeachment. Democrat Chair Jerry Nadler opened up the session with his remarks outlining what would take place.
Today we will begin our conversation where we should, with the text of the Constitution. We are empowered to recommend the impeachment of President Trump to the House if we find that he has committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Our witness panel will help us to guide that conversation.
In response, Republican Doug Collins, the ranking member, called into question the proceedings.
It didn't start with Mueller. It didn't start with a phone call. You know where this started? It started with tears in Brooklyn in November 2016, when an election was lost. So we are here, no plan, no fact witnesses, simply being a rubber stamp for what we have. But hey, we got law professors here. What a start of a party.
Before members of the committee got the opportunity to ask questions, each of the four witnesses made opening statements. Professor Noah Feldman from the Harvard Law School stated his conclusion about President Trump's behavior that led to today's hearing.
On the basis of the testimony and the evidence before the House, President Trump has committed impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors by corruptly abusing the office of the presidency.
Pamela Carlin from Stanford Law School said the case for impeachment was made clear from the testimony gathered by the House Intelligence Committee.
Everything I read on those occasions tells me that when President Trump invited, indeed demanded, foreign involvement in our upcoming election, he struck at the very heart of what makes this a republic to which we pledge allegiance. That demand, as Professor Feldman just explained, constituted an abuse of power.
University of North Carolina law professor Michael Gerhart also said, based on the evidence thus far, President Trump committed impeachable offenses, including
bribery, abuse of power, and soliciting a personal favor from a foreign leader to benefit himself personally, obstructing justice, and obstructing Congress.
Jonathan Turley from George Washington University told the committee that he voted against Trump in the 2016 election, but that was immaterial to the question at hand. He expressed his concerns about the process.
I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger. I believe this impeachment not only fails to satisfy the standard of past impeachments, but would create a dangerous precedent for future impeachments.
VOA will have ongoing coverage and analysis of the House impeachment inquiry on our website and our upcoming programs. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using the National Science Foundation's Green Bank Radio Telescope say they discovered a neutron star that is the most massive ever detected. The researchers found that this neutron star packs a mass 2.17 times that of our sun into a sphere that's a mere 30 kilometers in diameter. According to the researchers, this newly discovered neutron star is so heavy that if it had just a little more mass, it could have instead formed a black hole. Neutron stars are composed of the highly compressed remains of a giant star that exploded in a Type II supernova. This new discovery is also considered a pulsar, since observers here on Earth can detect the powerful beams of energy they emit from their magnetic poles. This neutron star spins so quickly that it would only take a couple of milliseconds for a full rotation. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. House of Representatives has overwhelmingly voted in favor of a bill that would aim to close mass detention camps for China's Uyghur Muslim community, as well as sanction Chinese officials involved in the detentions in the country's Xinjiang province. Reuters' Jason Albano has the details.
We are sending a message to Beijing. America is watching, and we will not stand silent.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke on Tuesday as the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a bill aimed at China's crackdown on its Muslim minority. The Uyghur Act of 2019 calls for the closure of mass detention camps in the province of Xinjiang. It would see sanctions imposed on a member of China's Politburo for the first time. The committee oversees China's Communist Party. The bill would also ban the export of surveillance technology to China. If passed, it will require the Trump administration to toughen its response to China's treatment of its Uyghur minority. Republican Congressman Chris Smith condemned Beijing's treatment of the community.
Children ripped from the warm embrace of their families to be indoctrinated in communist ideology and forced to renounce their religious culture and language. Rape, sexual abuse, and forced abortions of women being held in internment camps. Forced labor on a scale that allows Chinese companies to profit from modern-day slavery.
UN experts say as many as 1 million people are being held in the camps, but China has repeatedly denied mistreatment of its Uyghur population, saying that the camps are meant to provide vocational training. In a statement on Wednesday, China's foreign ministry called the bill a malicious attack. The revised bill will now need to be approved by the Republican-controlled Senate before being sent to Trump. The White House did not respond to requests for comment.
And that was Reuters reporter Jason Albano. The Syrian pound has been hitting new lows against the U.S. dollar in recent days, coming close to a record low of 1,000 pounds to the dollar before pulling back on Tuesday to about 920. Edward Uranian reports Arab analysts are attributing the deteriorating exchange rate to economic and political crises in the neighboring states, including Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran, all of which have close economic ties to Damascus.
Popular protests in Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran are causing major strains on the Syrian economy, which depends heavily on its neighbors for trade and various forms of economic assistance. Syria's currency, the pound, officially pegged at 430 to the dollar, has fallen to nearly 1,000 to the dollar in recent days, rising slightly Tuesday to about 920. The deteriorating value of the pound is creating major hardship for average Syrians. A middle-aged man in Damascus told Arab media he can't understand what's happening. He says the supermarket, the vegetable man, and the taxi drivers tell us that prices are rising because the dollar is rising. It makes no sense, though, he says, because we're in Syria and we're paid in Syrian pounds. Who cares what the dollar is worth? Another man insisted price rises are just a few pounds here and a few pounds there, but at the end of the day, it all adds up to a few hundred pounds, which is a fraction of a dollar. Many Syrian workers now make the equivalent of under $100 a month. Syrian opposition economist Usama al-Qadi told Arab media the Syrian economy is in dire straits. He says inflation is eating up Syrians' wealth and the economy is in a catastrophic state, reflecting a massive drop in purchasing power and demand. 80% of Syrians are below the poverty level, he says, and unemployment is over 70%. VOA could not independently confirm the figures. Lebanese economist Tawfiq Shuman told Al Ghad TV that there are close ties between the Syrian and Lebanese economies and that many Syrians have been keeping their money in Lebanese banks for decades. Hundreds of thousands of Syrians live in Lebanon, he adds, and they often send dollars to their families back in Syria. The Lebanese central bank recently restricted the amount of currency people could withdraw from their accounts, affecting both Lebanese and Syrians, and effectively crippling trade. The Syrian central bank also is forced to limit bank withdrawals. Syrians reportedly have more than $20 billion in Lebanese banks. Bassam Malik, a former member of the Syrian Chamber of Commerce, told the BBC Arabic service that Syrians are facing a tough winter with fuel shortages to heat their homes. He says the government is paralyzed and unable to make decisions. Nevertheless, he says, he doubts the time is right for a popular revolt, but adds that nothing is impossible if the Syrian pound continues to fall. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Families of several U.S. and British people held in Iran are expressing fear for their loved ones amid the deadliest unrest in decades in the Islamic Republic. Amnesty International says at least 208 people were killed by their nation's security forces, well above the initial estimate of only 57. The Iranian government disputes those findings, calling them lies. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Philippe Nassif, Advocacy Director for Middle East and North Africa. She began their conversation by asking him how the organization arrived at their conclusions.
We've been documenting human rights violations in Iran for a very long time, but we have not seen this level of unrest in the country in years and years. I mean, this has far surpassed the 2009 unrest, both in terms of scope and magnitude and certainly death toll. So we have human rights activists in Iran, and then also just regular Iranians that have been able to send through VPN due to the communication blackout, right? There's been a communication blackout that's been implemented by the government, so it's been very hard to get information out of Iran. But if you use VPN and other means, they've been able to send videos and eyewitness testimony of what has occurred in the streets of Iran, where many protesters have been gunned down over the last several weeks by the security services. And they've sent that to organizations such as Amnesty, and they've sent it to the State Department and to other human rights groups, and all of these folks have been able to document and compile these, you know, horrific actions that have occurred.
They shut down the internet. That would somewhat make sense that there might have been a reason behind what they did not want to get out to the rest of the world now that we have internet and social media. But why do you think that the government went to such lengths this time?
I think the government knows that the protests are widespread, for one, right? They're across multiple provinces and multiple cities, numerous cities across the country. So there's that. I think the magnitude of the protests have been quite large. And then take a look at the world right now and take a look at how many protests have been occurring, uprisings even, have been occurring from Iraq to Lebanon to Algeria and then across Latin America. There's a sense from some of these governments, and the Iranian government obviously falls into this category of, this is serious. This is a big deal. There is a movement that is not necessarily connected, but it's being inspired by the same economic conditions, poor economic conditions, corruption, lack of equitable governance, and human rights issues, human rights abuse that have pushed people to take to the streets because they have found no other alternatives to bring about change in their respective countries. And I think in Iran, you've seen decades of human rights abuses and little to show for the Iranian government's positions on a wide variety of issues, you know, internally and externally. And people have taken to the streets and they've vented their frustration at the government. The government is afraid of where that can go. They don't know where that ends up for them. So I think that they've gone to extreme measures.
It sounds like they're rejecting the numbers. That's not a huge surprise, but it sounds like you got your information from pretty good sources, from sometimes family members themselves who, according to Amnesty's statement, they also, the authorities, were threatening family members of victims that were killed?
Oh, yeah. You know, this is standard practice that the Iranian government does. They'll label numbers that are being put out by organizations such as Amnesty and others as, you know, a foreign plot and conspiracy theory, and They'll intimidate family members not to talk to the media, not to go online and post anything or share anything externally to family members outside of Iran. These are all standard. This is how the Iranian government operates in these situations. I think in particular, it's just the magnitude of these protests that's causing them to really double down on their go-to way of responding to these things. And I think, frankly, the number of people that have been able to speak about the killings in the streets and people being cornered in the marshes in one particular incident and being gunned down by these security services, I mean, it's gruesome and it's frightening to think how many more people have been killed that we haven't been able to verify. You know, this death toll can be much higher than what we have reported so far, and maybe that'll become more clear in the coming days and weeks. I don't know.
Are you continuing to investigate that?
Absolutely. We must and we will. Absolutely.
That was Amnesty International. National's Advocacy Director for Middle East and North Africa, Philippe Nassif, speaking to our own Lori London. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has called for the release of protesters who were arrested in recent demonstrations against a sharp hike in gas prices if they were unarmed and simply voicing their opinion. Protests erupted on November 15th after the government announced it was raising fuel prices by up to 200%, but were quickly stifled by security forces, who also imposed a week-long near-total internet blackout. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, our engineer, Nick Ivanov, and managing director, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you very much for joining us today. You'll be able to find continued and in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello and welcome to